some students visiting the court today, and we'd like for them to stand. Eisenhower High School in New Berlin, are they here? Would they stand? Thank you very much. Thank you. And as a pattern of the Chief Justice is, now that we know who you are, I just want to tell you who we are. Starting on my right, Justice Pat Crooks, Justice John Wilcox,
morning.
Don Steinmetz, myself. We have Justice Bill Babbage, Ann Walsh Bradley, and Dave Prosser. So now you know us and we know you. So we'll call the first case, which is State versus Deborah J.Z. And to argue will be Sally Hetzel. Is that how you say it? I'll say it again. Helza, thank you. And you will be introducing the lawyers who are going to argue. Okay, we'll call on you then.
May it please the court. My name is Sally Helzel, and I represent Deborah J.Z., the defendant appellant in this case. At this time, I would like to introduce my co-counsel, Priscilla Smith, who will be presenting our argument today.
Thank you. And before you commence with your argument, just let me inform you that the Chief Justice, Shirley Anderson, will not be participating in this case.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You've been admitted pro hoc vici.
I'm sorry?
You have been admitted pro hoc vici.
Yes, Your Honor, I have been. Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Priscilla Smith. I represent the defendant appellant, as my co-counsel has just told you. Your Honors, this case arouses strong emotions in all of us, I believe, both in those who sympathize with my client, as well as in those who would condemn her. But this case is not really about whether it should be criminalized for a pregnant woman to engage in self-destructive behavior that may harm her fetus. Rather, this case is about whether it was, in 1996, clearly a crime for a pregnant woman to abuse alcohol. Now, of course, there are many policy considerations that may factor into the court's decision, such as the fact that major medical groups from the AMA to the March of Dimes all oppose criminalization and fear that criminalization would actually harm babies and produce fewer healthy pregnancies and harm the health of the mothers and their children. Moreover, there are other, even pro-life groups oppose criminalization, some pro-life groups, because they fear for the same thing, that there would be harm to the health of the women and their babies, and also because they're concerned about an increase in abortions that could result from criminalization of self-destructive behavior during pregnancy. But again, this case isn't really about the policy considerations and whether it should be criminal. This case is about whether it was clearly when my client engaged in the behavior she's accused of here today, whether it was criminal for her to abuse alcohol, an otherwise completely legal behavior. Now, of course, the background of this case is that the cardinal principle of statutory construction here is one of strict construction of criminal laws. Penal statutes must always be strictly construed, and any ambiguity in the statutes whatsoever must be resolved in favor of my client.
Isn't our basic rule of construction to discern the intent of the legislature?
Yes, I believe that's right, Your Honor. And I believe that it's a strict construction in order to determine whether or not there was clear legislative intent. And I think the reason for that rule is it stems from our due process concerns about whether or not defendants actually had notice of what actions were criminal and what were not. And that makes this case vastly different from the case of Angela M.W. that this court considered last year.
Ms. Smith, if I might, let me interrupt on just the issue that you were touching on, and that's the due process issue and notice. In 1994, we had a situation where Cornelius, Kwiatkowski, State versus Black, and Angela, the Court of Appeals decision, had all been decided. Not the ultimate result of Angela here with this court, but the Court of Appeals decision, which was to the contrary. don't those decisions, standing as they did at the time of these acts, give notice to your client?
No, I don't believe they did, Your Honor.
Why not?
That's because all of those cases involved third parties, except for the Angela M.W. case, which was different. But the Cornelius case in particular, which the prosecution has relied on heavily here, involved a third party's actions that harmed a fetus. And the reason that's different, Your Honor, is because Cornelius was applying the born alive rule. It said that Wisconsin had codified the common law born alive rule and retained the born alive rule to the extent that it didn't conflict with the statutes. Now, the born alive rule under English common law throughout the history of this country has never, ever been applied against the pregnant woman. And in fact, its origins were to protect pregnant women. To protect them from harm caused by third parties, from attacks on their lives. And as we've argued in our briefs, I think that intellectually it also does make sense, because the born alive rule always involves some criminal intent towards a human being. And that criminal intent, in the case of a third party who attacks a pregnant woman, that's the criminal intent. And that criminal intent is then transferred onto the fetus if it is born alive.
Under the common law, was the fetus considered a human being?
No, it was not.
What's your authority for saying that?
Well, there's a number of cases, including a case out of Connecticut Supreme Court, State v. Carey, which concerns the abortion jurisprudence and says that, and Roe v. Wade itself, which says that at common law, abortion, for example, was not illegal. And the fetus was only considered a person in this one aspect, which was when the fetus was born alive after some action had been taken, and only in the context of the third party, when the pregnant woman had been attacked. The Florida Supreme Court's recent decision in State versus Ashley, which reversed that intermediate appellate court decision, which did apply the born alive rule to the pregnant woman, that was a case that the intermediate appellate court decision had been relied on by our opposing counsel. But the Florida Supreme Court unanimously reversed, and they said, this is a centuries-old principle of common law. And we, as the court, cannot overturn a centuries-old principle of common law which gave the woman immunity from prosecution, both in the abortion context as well as in the born-alive context, without clear legislative intent to do so.
Ms. Smith, you have on the opposite side, though, the Whitner versus State versus Whitner case coming out of South Carolina.
That's right.
So that's the other side of the coin, is it not?
Not exactly, Your Honor, because although that case did affirm criminalizing a pregnant woman's behavior, it did not rely on the born alive rule. What it said was a viable fetus is a person for purposes of our children's code. And that's exactly what this court said just a year ago was not true here in Wisconsin. So the South Carolina case has nothing to do with the born alive rule and didn't apply the born alive rule in any way, shape, or form.
Well, it does have to do, though, with the prosecution by the state of a woman for actions taken during the time she was pregnant.
That's correct.
The fact she was ingesting cocaine. Is that not correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. And I would say that the other distinction between that case and this case, in addition to the fact that the basis of the opinion has been rejected by this court, is that in that case, the woman was using an illegal substance. And the court, in fact, noted that. And they said she knew what she was doing was illegal. And although I don't agree with that opinion, at least there was some criminal intent there. In this case, there's no criminal intent whatsoever, because what you have is a woman who is abusing alcohol. And as much as we abhor the behavior and wish that people wouldn't abuse alcohol, it's not as yet illegal in this state for anyone to abuse alcohol, not even for a pregnant woman.
When you're talking about criminal intent, it's my recollection of the testimony at the preliminary hearing that there was testimony from a labor room or operating room technician, appears to be a practical nurse, to the effect that the client was making statements that she wanted that child dead, and that if she was released from the hospital, she was going to go out and keep drinking until that unborn child died, or if it was born, she was going to kill the child. Doesn't that in some way evince intent?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, the latter portion that there was a statement that once it was born, she was going to kill it. I don't recall that.
That's in the criminal complaint. I don't think it was presented at the preliminary hearing.
I don't think it was presented at the preliminary hearing. There is a statement, and I agree with you. I think that statement has, there are two things about that statement. First of all, in my opinion, it's open to interpretation whether that's an I'm going to do this or it's a cry for help. She says, if you don't keep me here, here I am. I am a, you know, extremely intoxicated woman. I'm fearful about labor and delivery. If you don't keep me here, this is what I'm going to do. That, to me, is a cry for help. But even if you interpret it as an intent to do something, the only intent that's evidenced in that statement is an intent to commit feticide, perhaps, or an intent to abort a fetus, perhaps, both of which, from which, the pregnant woman is immune from liability again by the Wisconsin legislature. So again, I think over and over again, the Wisconsin legislature has indicated that it has intended to maintain the common law immunity the pregnant woman had, that it doesn't want to pit woman against fetus, and that it rejects criminalization for feticide, for abortion. It's done it again and again and again. In fact, just this past year, and I think it's Act 292 or 295 of the Wisconsin Acts, the legislature once again, it's 295, Your Honor, there's a new feticide statute. And once again, the legislature said the pregnant woman is immune from this liability. Again and again and again, this is what the legislature has done. So I don't see where, as a matter of due process, which is what Your Honor's original question was, where any woman could have had notice that there was a criminalization of legal behavior, otherwise legal behavior.
I don't mean to hog the questioning here, but I'm concerned about your last statement. Are you now arguing that basically she was attempting abortion?
I'm not arguing that, Your Honor, but I'm arguing that if the statement, I'm going to go home and kill this thing, if that has any meaning outside of the ravings of an intoxicated woman who is fearful and wanted help, if it has any meaning, it's an intent not to deliver the fetus alive and then kill it. It's an intent to go home and drink herself to death, which is going to also kill the fetus that's inside her. And that intent, if it's anything, is an intent to commit feticide, which she's exempt from. She's immune from liability for.
The reason I'm asking is because my recollection is that Judge Barry, in his written decision after the motions to dismiss were brought after the filing of the information, specifically found that this was not an attempted abortion, and that no argument had been made in that regard, and that there were no inferences or conclusions that would lead to that conclusion. Is that not correct?
Well, I think it's right that he said that. I think it's a semantic argument of what is an abortion. Is an abortion a termination of a pregnancy other than to produce a live birth, which is how it's defined in the statutes? And is that what she's saying she's going to do? But again, Your Honor, I don't think that intent really factors into here, because if it's feticide intent, then she's immune. If it's an abortion, she's immune from liability. And if it's under the born alive rule of Cornelius, no pregnant woman has ever been held liable under the born alive rule, and there's nothing in the code that abrogates that immunity, and you have to have a clear abrogation of a common law rule. There is nothing. In fact, everything, again and again and again, the legislature has immunized the pregnant woman from liability for policy concerns. And that is, after all, the role of the legislature, to consider all the policy issues that are out there. And they've done it this past year. They looked at this issue of substance abuse, and they decided that juvenile court judges should have the authority to order women into treatment, to require women to be in inpatient treatment or outpatient treatment, but they did not criminalize it. They rejected criminalization again and again.
You gave us the definition of abortion. What was your citation for that?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I don't know if I... Hold on.
Under 940.04, just any person who intentionally destroys the life of an unborn child other than the mother. Is that the only definition we find in the statutes?
It may be, Your Honor. In my experience, abortion has always been defined as termination of a human pregnancy other than to produce a live birth. But it may be that that's not found in the code here. I misspoke.
Counsel, in focusing on the statute or statutes, one of your arguments in statutory construction is essentially plain meaning with regard to the homicide charge. You say under 939.22.16 that human being, as defined in the statute, it means, when used in homicide sections, anyone who has been born alive. That sub 16 specifically refers to homicide sections and is an argument that you advance. What about with regard to the reckless injury? How can you make the same argument that human being means someone born alive is defined in sub 16, and sub 16 specifically refers to homicide?
Well, I think you have to look at other acts of the legislature to decide how they've defined human being and person. Certainly, this court held in Angela M.W. that person did not include a fetus. The court in Roe v. Wade, the U.S. Supreme Court, held that person does not include a fetus. So again, I think using those two definitions, the only definition you could possibly fall back on for the reckless injury statute is perhaps the human being definition under the homicide statute as some indication of legislative intent of what they mean by human being, what they mean by person, and that they meant to adopt the born alive rule. It's arguable whether they meant to adopt the born alive rule for all their criminal statutes, or did they only mean to adopt it for the homicide statutes? I think that's an outstanding issue that hasn't been decided by this court or by a lower court, as far as I know. It's been decided in Cornelius that the born alive rule was adopted for purposes of the homicide statute because of that definition. But it's possible, and one could argue, that it wasn't adopted for the others. I don't think this court need to make that decision. Or decide that in this case. Again, because the born alive rule in its common law origins and as adopted by the Wisconsin legislature in the criminal code has never applied to the pregnant woman. Not in any case in Great Britain, not in any case in the United States. And the reason for that is because there is a fundamental distinction between a third party who harms the pregnant woman and the pregnant woman harming herself. It's a fundamental distinction that's recognized in the law in abortion jurisprudence, that this is a different kind of relationship, and it's been recognized by many courts who've rejected, in 20 states, have rejected these kind of prosecutions.
Now, in Cornelius, recollect the facts for me. That was why don't you give it to me real quickly?
In that case, it was I believe that was the case where the man forced the woman to come with him on a joyride or a death ride. He was intoxicated. They crashed into a tree. She was pregnant. The fetus was born alive and died.
And so there, although he did not intend harm to the fetus, nevertheless, because harm did result to the fetus, born alive,
that's
the prosecution
right.
Went forward.
And there was...
Why isn't that somewhat the same here, analogously? In other words, the theory being, why can't the state advance the theory that here the mother did not intend harm to the child? She intended harm to herself. She essentially is the third, she's taking whatever means she can to harm herself. The unintended victim is the fetus. But nevertheless, she's responsible.
Well, that is the argument that they've made, Your Honor, and my response to it has been twofold. One, the pregnant woman's immune under that doctrine, and there's no indication
of the legislature. Could you repeat that, please? I didn't hear you.
I'm sorry. That I have two responses, or I guess I've had a number of responses in the brief, but that the pregnant woman is immune under that theory, that it's never been applied, and so there's no notice of it, even if this court were now to adopt it. But second, also, that there's no criminal intent there. Suicide's not illegal in Wisconsin. There's no criminal intent when what you do is intend to harm yourself. We can harm ourselves. It's one of the freedoms, albeit good or bad, but it's one of the freedoms that we have, is how we treat our own bodies.
Well, if I take a gun to try to shoot myself, and the bullet passes through my body, hits somebody behind me.
Right.
Are you saying that I can't be charged with the harm done to that person?
No, of course you can, Your Honor, and that's because that person is a living, breathing person who you have killed or harmed. In this context, you have a fetus, not a person, and the courts have said, and the common law said, that that fetus only becomes a person in the context where there is some other criminal intent. There's no criminal intent when a pregnant woman harms herself and the fetus is later born alive.
Did the Florida court, when it was addressing the recent case of, I think it was a woman, pregnant woman, trying to commit suicide, right? Is that...
That's exactly what they said. And they addressed the common law issues in depth. They discussed the common law born alive rule. They didn't talk about this particularized transferred intent doctrine. That's really, was a judge in New Jersey who raised that first, and... I think it explains the born alive rule intellectually, and when you read the cases, the born alive cases, they all talk about a man who shoots a pregnant woman and then this happened, the man who hits his girlfriend and then this happens, and the purpose behind the born alive rule being to prevent the harm to the pregnant woman and to additionally punish him then for the death of the fetus that results. The transferred intent theory, I think, is a relatively new one as a way to explain why the born alive rule is as it is. But the fact remains that it's never been applied to the pregnant woman's actions. So I think if this court were now to decide to apply it here, that it would be ex post facto as applies to Deborah Zimmerman, that there's no indication whatsoever in 1996, that this court would adopt that new rule that no other court has adopted.
Let's say, for example, that this court, assuming that your arguments are correct, looking at what the trial court did, and obviously to get to where he, in this case, had gone, he had to say, well, this is not abortion, and then he extrapolated from that. Mm-hmm. But this case is, I think the facts are particularly egregious in the relationship between the act of drinking, having a .3, having a child born with almost a .199, is something that in today's society we all recognize that danger, and the danger of convulsion, seizures, mental retardation, failure to thrive, whatever. Factually, and I know this is a slippery slope, but if we, and I hate to talk about that argument, but I think it's obvious that one of the concerns is, if you ever did that, where would you stop?
Right.
And that's obviously your concern. But could we just take a look at the facts of this case, because this is where .3, C-section delivery, and child being born alive with obvious defects. I mean, that's the situation, not hypothetically bringing in everything else. Do you see some responsibility of the state in those situations? I mean, we're talking about, you know, that there was a Casey in Dole, the Roe case, rather, Roe versus Wade. Obviously, the state has an interest in children who are viable. I mean, that's the U.S. Supreme Court has said that in Planned Parenthood versus Casey. Now, I'm just extrapolating from that to this case. These facts, do you think the court can address these facts just the way they are without getting into some of the other issues, or saying this is the stopping point. When this happens, this is why we would involve ourselves. What do you think of that?
Of course, my answer is no, Your Honor.
Yeah, I knew your answer.
Which knew what my answer would be. My reasoning, I think that when you're talking about legal behavior, saying that there's a stopping point at abuse of alcohol, it doesn't make sense in terms of harm to children, if that's your purpose. And two, I don't know how you really stop that. How do you stop something at alcohol and not say smoking, cigarettes, and all the other slippery slope arguments that we've
made? Common sense will tell you that smoking cigarettes at, when the delivery was less than a week away, we're talking about something where the cause and effect were medically provable. In other words, it's even different than the cocaine case that you talked about. Krasicki was different. This is right on the facts. That's what I'm talking about. Just exactly that medically you could show that the ingestion, and you had the statement, and then you had the grievous result.
I don't see how you could limit it to this kind of situation, Your Honor, and not have it take into account a number of other situations as well that would be similar. If a woman is 8 months pregnant and she...
two days from
delivery, the same facts, and her doctor says, you're having Braxton Hicks, you're having false labor, there's something, you know, you've had gestational diabetes, whatever it is, you stay in bed, and she doesn't stay in bed, she's going to do similar harm to her fetus. Not to mention the fact that when you smoke during pregnancy, particularly in the first trimester, the evidence is that you cause more harm by smoking than by doing anything else. There's nothing else that's been proven to be as harmful to babies,
including alcohol,
than smoking. Maybe alcohol and cigarettes, I suppose, depending on the amounts, are similar problems. But in terms of the public health issues, I'm sorry.
No, I'd say that's why I wanted to just talk about this case with the fact situation, because I think that I wouldn't disagree with smoking, but I think that this is just that absolute direct relation that medically we know from. She was intoxicated. The baby was born with this high alcohol content, and the effects were immediate.
Well, Your Honor, I don't know if that's even true in the facts of this case.
Because that's the facts that I read the case.
I still don't see how you limit and how you find a clear legislative intent to criminalize that one narrow fact pattern and not others. How you make that distinction. That's the kind of distinction that I think is best left to the legislature. And for the court to try to find one little piece of it and finagle and rewrite the statutes, I think is not really the role of the courts. I think my time is up.
May I ask you, your discussion has been almost entirely on the law now.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Your discussion has been almost entirely on the law as it exists right now. What power under the Constitution does the legislature have to protect children like MMZ and the public that might be required to support them?
Well, I think, Your Honor, that's an open question under federal constitutional law, at least, under privacy law, whether the legislature does have the power to criminalize, start with illegal drugs. I think that's probably easier, the use of illegal drugs during after the fetus is viable. The state clearly has an interest in protecting the health and the life of fetuses post-viability, and it may be that the states have that power based on that interest. It hasn't been decided by the Supreme Court, but I wouldn't be surprised if states do indeed have that power, and the Supreme Court would leave that standing. The issue of legal behavior and whether or not you can control a woman's legal behavior during the, let's say, post-viability, which would be the strongest argument, I think is a tougher question. The Supreme Court in Casey, in rejecting the spousal consent provision that Pennsylvania had imposed on abortions in the Casey case, rejected spousal consent and said, what's next? Women have to tell their husbands when they're smoking or drinking. So there's some indication that the Supreme Court thought that's legal behavior. If a woman can engage in legal behavior, one woman and the pregnant woman, why can't she and a man? We all, this is legal behavior. But again, that's an open question. I don't think it's been answered or tested. And it probably would be tested if a state did pass such a law criminalizing legal behavior only for pregnant women. I think you'd have some equal protection issues that could be raised. Is it a status crime you're creating? Those sorts of arguments. But it certainly has not been tested against the state's interest in post-viability fetuses.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you. I'll call next on you'll have 5 minutes for a rebuttal. Mary Bowman, Assistant Attorney. Okay, we got the wrong case. Yeah. All right.
How'd
you like to be Joan Coyle?
Right now?
Yeah. Okay. I had the Assistant Attorney General right there.
Justices, may it please the Court. I'm Joan Korb. I'm an Assistant District Attorney for Racine County, representing the interests of the state of Wisconsin. The issues before this Court are ones of statutory construction and the application of state criminal statutes to profound social issues and problems, including child protection and the rights of our most vulnerable crime victims. It is not, as has been stated earlier, a case about abortion rights or defendants' right to choose. Defendants' right to choose is not threatened by this case. No one's right to choose should be threatened by this case. The defendant appellant was charged in a two-count information with attempted first-degree intentional homicide and first-degree reckless injury. Both present difficult issues of first impression in Wisconsin. Circuit Court Judge Dennis Berry, in his 18-page decision and order, found probable cause to support the charges. The state urges that this court affirm Judge Berry's decision. Each charge has elements that must be proven. At a preliminary hearing, the burden is to a degree of probable cause. As to the first degree reckless injury.
First degree murder.
I'm sorry?
First degree reckless injury.
Reckless injury. That was the second of the two charges. The preliminary hearing transcript is replete with testimony that the defendant caused great bodily harm to a human being. A question was asked earlier about the definition of human being. The only definition in the criminal code for human being is within the homicide statute. Secondly,
Ms. Korb, let me stop you at that point, since you've just made a point that gives me some concern. Human being in 939.22.16, as I understand it, is defined as one who is born alive. But that section makes it clear that that applies only to the homicide sections. There's no mention of reckless injury. How do you get over that hurdle? It seems to me you've got a much stronger argument because of 939.22.16 on your attempted first-degree intentional homicide than you have on reckless injury. How do you get through that?
Absolutely. The state believes, Your Honor, that our case in regards to the reckless injury is far stronger than the homicide. However, we believe that based upon public policy and the interpretations that this court and other appellate courts have placed on the born alive rule, that there is also jurisdiction on the attempted first degree intentional homicide. Because the child was born alive, the intent that the defendant had toward her fetus continued on.
What was the intent of the first-degree murder charge?
The intent was initially to kill the fetus.
Okay.
In a first-degree intentional homicide.
When did that occur?
It initially occurred earlier on before the delivery of the baby.
Right.
But in an intentional homicide, that intent, the state argues, could, if the...
Well, if the intent was to kill the baby, I've got two roads I want to go down with you, so I'll take the first road. And I don't want to try to play hide the ball with you, so the first road is the problems that you run into with the feticide and the abortion statute. If the intent is, as you say, to kill the baby, the fetus, right?
Right.
That, to me, sounds like feticide. 940.04 says any person other than the mother who intentionally destroys the life of an unborn quick child. Why isn't that feticide?
That's correct, because in this
why case, isn't it?
Why isn't it?
Yes.
Because the child was born alive. A feticide, an abortion, assumes the death of the unborn child.
Are you saying that you could not charge a person with attempted feticide?
I don't believe that attempted feticide exists.
Why is that? If a man comes up, or a third person comes up and attempts to punch the mother in the stomach to destroy the life of the fetus, and he does not succeed, are you saying he can't be charged with attempted feticide?
That's correct.
I guess you and I disagree on
okay.
that.
Okay. What you have is a battery to the mother. Mm-hmm. If he's successful in battering her, you might have an attempted battery, but, you know, if he did strike her with the intent, I mean, and I think that's something that...
With the intent to destroy the life of the unborn quick child.
That would be the Black case, where his intent was to kill the baby.
Right.
If the baby had been born alive, we'd have, and then died, you'd have a situation where could he have been charged then with a homicide, because his intent went to a non-human being, the fetus, but he wound up, the child being born alive, killing a human being. Can you transfer that intent then from a non-human being to the human being? And the state is saying, yes, you can. That's what this case would extrapolate from the Black case.
Well, clearly the statute, what I hear you saying, counsel, is if she had succeeded, since the intent was aimed at the fetus, you've admitted that, I mean, that's
yes.
part of your case. Had she succeeded in destroying the life of that child, she could not have been prosecuted.
That's correct. It would have been a completed abortion for which we could not charge.
Or completed feticide, either one.
That's correct.
So by failing to succeed, she can be prosecuted.
That's correct.
Does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does, because I think there's some public policy considerations. If she successfully terminates the pregnancy, we don't have a child that's suffering the consequences of the actions, whether it's drinking or doing drugs or any of those things. And we don't have society bearing perhaps the cost of raising that child or the cost of repairing the damage done. So I think there are some public policy issues that would support that interpretation.
Counsel,
I mean, as ridiculous as it is.
If I may go down the second road, then I'll try to sit down and be quiet. The second road that I want to pursue with you is when the offense occurred. Now, the baby was born with a .199.
That's correct.
When did this offense occur?
The actual offense was...
At what point of intoxication?
At the point where the child's life was endangered.
At what point is that?
I guess we have to leave that to medical experts.
Are you asking...
In hindsight...
Far as I can see, looking up and down this bench, there aren't any.
Right, but I think that's something that each case, you have to look at each case individually and look at the proof.
What if the baby had been born with a .10? Would you be here?
Maybe not. It would depend upon what condition the child was in. This case...
Don't you have a real problem of notice and due process at that point? I mean, you're asking the mother to guess at how many drinks she can take before she can be charged?
I believe that the conduct itself is so egregious. And with the intent that we have in this case, I think we really have to focus in this case on the facts that we have before us. another case with different facts where the mother did not express an intent to kill the child and consumed alcohol so that the child was born with a 0.10, we'd have to evaluate that case in view of those facts.
Cigarette smoking.
In all of these cases where you start talking about this slippery slope...
Well, there's a line. I recognize
the state, in a lot of these cases, will have proof problems. And that, I think, will limit a lot of these slippery slope type cases that people that are alarmed over this type of case...
Would you concede that this court does not have the power to say that it's a crime if the baby is born at 0.15, but it's not a crime if the baby is born under 0.15?
I don't think that you can make a blanket legislative decision.
If the legislature said that, there'd be no problem, correct?
But the legislature cannot draft legislation and know the probable fact scenarios for every situation that a statute might be applied to.
But you feel this court can. I think this, I asked opposing counsel this, you know, this is, the facts of this case are particularly egregious. I think we all understand that. But it is, from a public policy standpoint, where do we stop? Where do you think this court, do we stop with this case? That's what Justice Babbage is referring to. And is this something the court can jump into and make these decisions, just say, all right, it's limited to this fact situation? Because that really, you know, we're not just looking at this case, we're looking at a lot of other potential cases coming up here.
Ultimately, an affirmation of Judge Barry's decision might only apply to this case. We don't know how prosecutors might apply it to another case. We don't know if we're ever going to have a fact situation like this again. I hope not. I think just as every decision that this court makes, unless it just involves, you know, an issue between two parties that's unique to those two parties, we can't know whether or not there's going to be far-reaching implications, whether some rogue prosecutor is going to charge a woman who has a drink during her first trimester, although I would submit that since the state does not have an interest, a compelling interest during the first trimester, that would be successful, even though we all know that the most damage is done through drinking during the first trimester.
Ms. Clark, let me follow through, if I might, with Justice Wilcox and Justice Babbage's questions and pose it somewhat differently. It strikes me when we start talking about slippery slope that the slope is a lot slipperier when you start talking about reckless injury as against the other charge here of attempted first-degree intentional homicide. Do you agree with that?
I would agree with that, yes.
Why do you think that's true?
Because it's not quantitative. Like, do you, 0.10 versus 0.199. You can't put a percentage on it. You can't put a definite number upon what's going to be charged and what isn't. You have to look at the circumstances surrounding those facts. And I think the intentional homicide and the reckless injury statutes both look at the conduct and why the conduct was undertaken and the consequences of that conduct. And so I don't see prosecutors charging women for smoking cigarettes or having a few drinks because there's still a certain burden of proof that they have to meet. What jury is going to convict a woman of reckless injury for smoking a couple of cigarettes or having a couple of drinks?
Let me ask you one other question, if I might. Do you concede that if this court were to accept your argument, that we would have to limit the holding to when a fetus was viable? Based on Casey, based on Roe v. Wade, do you think we would have to limit it to viability?
On the reckless injury, I don't believe it would have to be limited to viability because a I think in a situation when you're talking about alcohol, it's common knowledge that alcohol is very damaging to the fetus, and if that child then was born with, let's say, fetal alcohol syndrome and was severely mentally retarded, and you could make that nexus, the causation. I think that's the problem you're going to have going back to the first trimester. I don't think you can eliminate it, but it would be difficult for prosecutors to show that the alcohol, perhaps, during the first trimester resulted in the fetal alcohol syndrome at birth. It could have come from some other factor.
Well, given the language in Roe v. Wade and in Casey that certainly emphasizes the last trimester, the third trimester, or emphasizes viability, where then it triggers the state's compelling interest, don't you think in both situations there would have to be a limitation of viability?
I think that it would be self-limiting. I believe that because the proof problems would be so difficult prior to viability that we would be focused primarily on when the child reaches viability, when the state has a compelling interest.
Counsel, you seem to, with regard to the reckless injury, concede it is a greater slippery slope. How's that for comparative terms? And I'm a bit perplexed by this reckless injury charge. Is the state suggesting that one episode of getting drunk and intoxication on a specific day and time, is it your position that that recklessly injured the child?
In this case, it did, because when this woman presented to the emergency room and was taken to the obstetrics unit with a 0.302 blood alcohol, they attempted to monitor her. They found out that the baby's fetal heart tones were flat, which meant the baby wasn't doing well. They did a sonogram. The baby wasn't moving much. When the child was born, the child was very limp. The child was not doing well at all.
So I just want to understand your case. So your assertions have nothing to do with fetal alcohol syndrome, because that happens in the first 3 months. Your assertion is there's one day she was at the bar, had some white Russians, and taken to the hospital. That's the basis of your charge then? Or is it what she was doing in the first 3 months that caused the fetal alcohol syndrome? What's the injury you're alleging here?
It was primarily the condition of the child at birth, where the level of intoxication could have caused death.
That's the homicide part, reckless injury. I want to just focus. You said primarily. Is it your position that any injury that's associated with fetal alcohol syndrome is totally irrelevant in your case? Because that's not what your case is about.
No, it's not irrelevant. One of the elements.
So what happened during the first 3 months with regard to fetal alcohol syndrome is part of your reckless injury charge? I'm just trying to understand.
A very small part. It's primarily the condition of the child at birth and her actions prior to the birth. In a reckless injury, you have to prove that the defendant caused great bodily harm, and I think we have that in this case, that the great bodily harm was caused by criminally reckless conduct, and that it showed the defendant showed an utter disregard for human life.
When did she cause it?
When she started drinking that day.
That day. And drinking that day, one bout, has nothing to do with fetal alcohol syndrome. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So your case has nothing to do with fetal alcohol syndrome?
In a very technical sense, for the reckless injury, no, it does not.
So you're charging her for having 3 or 4 or 2, whatever it is, white Russians on a specific day. Is that what you're charging her with?
Essentially. Because the child suffered the effects of that day at birth. And but for the intervention of the doctors, the child may have died.
So that's the way you want us to write this case, so that if we know, and that this public policy argument is really concerning, because this court doesn't just write for this one case, we're writing for a lot more, as we indicated.
I don't want the court to narrowly write it just for the actions on that one day, because
But if we don't, I think it should be obvious. I say, but if we don't put limitations, what was suggested here by my colleagues and your answers, this is, if we're going to be in a real morass as far as any expectation of how people would even judge their behavior. So that's one of the concerns I have, is how would we limit this?
Well, I think it's, again, self-limiting by what a prosecutor could prove in a court of law.
Counsel,
what do you mean by that?
Because for behavior that occurs early on in a pregnancy that may not be observed, that no one knows about, that 20%, for instance, 20% of all children, babies, are born with a low birth weight. That might be because of alcohol consumption by the mother. It may be because of cigarette smoking. It may be that it's just a low birth weight child. So I think that this...
You're not suggesting that that type of case would be one that this court would be considering?
Heavens no. Heavens no. I would see that a situation like this would arise rarely, where you could actually have an intent and an act and the results that was provable.
In your reckless injury charge, let me give you a hypothetical. Woman of the year, she's great. Everyone loves her. In fact, she never drinks, and she's pregnant. And lo and behold, unfortunately, she goes out to some party, and because she's not used to drinking, just consumes way too much, goes into delivery, hardly had a drop in her life before, and the baby's born with 0.12 because of that one night when she had 3 white Russians. Should the state be allowed to charge her with reckless injury?
In your hypothetical, no, because you haven't shown any injury.
Okay, I don't say the baby, as a result of being 0.12, is obviously slower in the birthing process, isn't when they do the scale of 1 to 10,
the Apgars.
That's right. It comes out a 6 rather than a nice 8 or 9,
Again, I don't believe so, because we don't have any permanent or protracted injury.
For reckless injury, do you need permanent?
Well, the jury instructions shed a lot of light on what the definitions of all these elements are.
Isn't the injury you're talking about then fetal alcohol syndrome, which isn't the one night bout with 3 or 4 Russians, but what happened? White Russians, excuse me. But let's say the other kinds of Russians, you wouldn't want that. Other than the first 3 months, it seems to me you're saying to us it's because the child was born with 1.9 as a result of that one night, but then you're tying in what happened the first month, the second month, maybe even before she knew that she was pregnant, because that's when the fetal alcohol syndrome occurs.
But if she did it before she even knew she was pregnant, then we don't have criminally reckless conduct, and we don't have an utter disregard for human life. If she knows she's pregnant and she's engaging in that behavior and she doesn't care, then I believe she should be prosecuted. If that child is born suffering the effects, especially if they're permanent effects, because that child's going to suffer for the rest of its life.
Would you have charged her if there wasn't this one night bout, but she was born with fetal alcohol syndrome? Should she be charged? The child was born with fetal alcohol syndrome, she should be charged?
I doubt that we would have heard about it.
Should all people who have fetal alcohol syndrome children, and it's brought to your attention through social services, be charged with reckless injury?
No. I don't think you could meet the burden of proof in every case. I mean, this case was so egregious. We have the comments, the statements that she made.
Ms. Carr, let me interrupt you and ask you something further. I know that not all of this came out at the preliminary hearing, but in the criminal complaint, as I read it, there is information indicating that the mother in this case, the defendant in this case, was involved in ripping off the monitors so that the nurses were not able to check on the child's heartbeat, the fetal heartbeat, that she was refusing blood tests because, again, the nurses were concerned that they could not monitor the condition of the unborn child. Is that at all significant to your charge of attempted homicide?
That's a good question. I think it all goes to the totality of her acts. And each one of those acts, no matter how minute, create the large picture here, and all goes to show her intent. Whether, you know, the intent was just directed at a fetus, or the fetus, or the intent continued, whether or not this child was born alive. So the state is saying that if the child, or if a child is born alive, I think in a situation like this where she knew that drinking alcohol could be fatal to her child, that intent, that one of the probabilities here was that this child could have been born alive and then died because of the exposure to the alcohol and her actions, both while pregnant and after the delivery of this child.
Ms. Korb, if this mother had taken two or three more White Russians, had drank two or three more White Russians, and instead of a 0.199, the child was exceedingly intoxicated to the point where the child did not survive birth, that the child was killed while in the womb. As I understand it, we wouldn't be here.
That's correct. As outrageous as that is, I believe because of the abortion statutes, although I would note in the dissent that you authored, I believe.
I authored the majority opinion in Black, in which we upheld the constitutionality of the feticide statute.
Right. But there was a dissent in that case that stated that it shouldn't, that the statute should not have been applied
right.
in that case.
Right. I didn't write that dissent.
Okay. Sorry. My mistake.
And I always look at these cases trying to figure out, okay, what's the overriding issue here? Tell me if you think I'm wrong or right or partially right or wrong. As I see it, much of this case hinges on us determining whether a fetus is a human being for purposes of the first-degree murder statute and for purposes of the reckless injury statute.
No, I don't see
that.
I don't see that that's the issue at all. I see the issues being whether or not activities that were put into place or started when there was a fetus, but they affect a child that's born alive, a human being,
mm-hmm.
whether or not this court will allow that. And I think there's also just tremendous public policy issues here.
But the statute on intentional murder says, well, you know what it says as well as I do, whoever causes the death of another human being. And you're saying that you told me a half an hour ago that the gravamen of this offense was her intention to kill the fetus.
However,
I'm hooking up my argument from a half an hour ago, and I'm just trying to understand it. So it seems to me that in order for you to succeed, we must say that the legislature intended that within the words human being is encompassed a fetus.
No, because the intent continued after the birth of the child. That there was a substantial probability that if this child were born alive, the child could die from the effects of the alcohol exposure. And I don't think it's necessary to define a fetus as a human being outside of the homicide statutes. And like I said, the legislature has no idea how what fact situations are going to be applied to what law.
But, Ms. Cook, you did say, didn't you, in response to a question I asked early on, that the intent here was to kill her fetus?
Yes, it was. Okay. But it was also to kill the child, whether born alive or as a fetus.
Ms. Korb, if you accept Justice Babbage's issue, then 939.22 paren 16 is extremely important, is it not?
It would be much easier for the state to prove its case if a fetus was defined as a human being.
Well, isn't that what that section does by saying that one who is born alive is a human being?
Yes.
And we don't have a parallel statute, do we, in regard to reckless injury?
That's correct.
Isn't that significant?
Yes, it is. And that's why I believe that the reckless injury is far easier to prove.
Easier?
Easier to prove?
Yeah, she does. That's what she thinks.
I know what you said. I'm just wondering.
Reckless injury, because... And you don't need... With reckless injury, you don't need to have the intent. It's just your conduct, your reckless disregard, your behavior towards the fetus that was then born alive.
Justice Steinmetz, may I ask a question?
One more.
Thank you. Let me make sure I understand. You're saying it's not necessary to define a fetus as a human being. You don't agree with the issue that was posed by Justice Babbage. It's not necessary to define a fetus as a human being because of the born alive rule. Is that your position?
Yes.
And if we adopt the born alive rule, then you prevail. If we don't adopt the born alive rule, then you don't prevail? If this is the way you frame the issue.
In regards to the homicide?
Or in regards to both? You said it's not necessary to define fetus as human being, essentially, because of the born alive rule. So if we adopt the born alive rule, your position can prevail. If we don't adopt the born alive rule, as you have